Good afternoon, everyone. It's Dr. Nigro again, our next episode of Psychology Unplugged. Thank you, as always, to all our followers, both here in the United States and internationally. It's a pleasure to be able to do this program on a weekly basis, and you know, the audience that we have never believed it would grow to the size it has and reach the magnitude that it has. And I'm very grateful to have this opportunity every week. And as always, I really appreciate when people come from different parts of the United States, different parts of Massachusetts, different parts of the globe for neuropsych evals. And I'm just very passionate about this field and the intricacies of it. And we're still are chipping away, getting globally at legitimizing and destigmatizing mental health, but I thought there's definitely a lot of work that needs to be done. So I'll give you my contact information after this episode, but somebody reached out to me the other day and emailed me four questions, and I decided and said that so, hi, Dr. Nigro. I've been intrigued by many of the episodes in your podcast, and it's brought up a few questions for me. If you find any of these questions to be of use for future podcasts or Q&A, feel free to use them. And they're questions related primarily to borderline, bipolar, and narcissism. So I will protect the let this individual may remain anonymous at some future point. They want me to mention their name, but I think these are great questions. And I'm doing this podcast kind of more old school when I first started the podcast, just off the top of my head, because I think these are questions that are very relevant and ones that I confront on a daily basis, both doing diagnostics and also primarily treating borderline personality disorder. So let's start with a question number one. Regarding bipolarity and BPD, I'm curious how often you see the scenario happen. I see the scenario happen quite a bit, but these are two totally distinct disorders. Borderline is something that is learned and is a product of environments and product of early learning and attachment theory and learning theory and behavioral theory, whereas bipolarity is strictly neurotransmission. It is chemical dysregulation in the brain. This person goes on to say that someone she knew was initially diagnosed as borderline with bipolar tendencies. She says, I'm not sure what that means exactly, bipolar tendencies. And I'm going to say, I don't know what that means. That means someone doesn't know how to do accurate diagnoses. Now, can you have tendencies of personality disorders? Yes. Tendencies of bipolar? Not necessarily, because you don't have partial neurological dysregulation. That's either you have the disorder or you don't. You either have mania or hypomania or you don't. Now, it could be something like cyclothymic disorder where you do not meet full criteria for a major depressive episode or full criteria for a manic or hypomanic episode. But I see this a lot in terms of people who report being they were discharged from an inpatient unit, and I've mentioned this on I think the episode I did on psychiatric hospitalizations, that bipolar and schizoaffective disorder are very common diagnoses given on an inpatient unit or even in residential settings. And the case is that is really not the case, because I ran a psychiatric hospital back in Chicago and had patients tested when I put in a clinical training model, and I realized that very few people actually have those. Were the people who had those diagnoses? Absolutely. But a vast majority were misdiagnosed. And a lot of times, you know, in emergency room settings or inpatient settings, it's all about stabilization and getting people two places where they're safe for themselves and they're safe to be around other people. But she goes on to say, but after a suicide attempt, she went back into treatment and was then diagnosed as bipolar. Does this sort of thing happen because patients aren't open and honest with their care providers? Or does this happen because many care providers don't believe in diagnosing people until they are at least 18 years old? Or is it because care providers are constrained to an unreasonably short amount of time in making a formal diagnosis? So, first part, does this sort of thing happen because patients aren't open and honest with their care providers? Yes. It could definitely, you know, the vast majority of people that I work with are honest, and they are coming looking for answers and a definitive diagnostic picture. Are there people that, you know, lie and don't share everything? Yeah, but I think that's more, why are you investing this much of your time and finances to be dishonest? At least from my perspective in doing diagnostics, you know, as you become more acclimated to working in this environment and working with this population and using the Socratic dialogue, and this is why behavioral observations are a crucial part of the diagnostic process and even the psychotherapeutic process, in watching body language and watching body movements. It's a lot of times I've said this before, if I ask somebody any history of suicidal ideations and there's a pause, or someone says, not really, I'm going to kind of back up a second, or I'm going to make a note to maybe revisit that. And I see this sometimes a lot with adolescents who, you know, their parents are in the room giving, you know, providing, you know, a lot of background information. And then once the parents leave, I will revisit a lot of questions, whether it's about substance abuse or, you know, high-risk behaviors or suicidal ideations or attempts or tendencies, as well as homicidal and self-injurious behavior. So, you know, you're good clinicians are going to be able to sniff out somebody who's not being honest. But it's really, you know, does it happen? Of course it happens. You know, the reasons for it could be just pathological lying. The reasons could be shame, which I find to be probably one of the more common reasons that people aren't as honest. But yeah, does it happen? Absolutely. The next part of this question is, or does this happen because many care providers don't believe in diagnosing people until they are at least 18 years old? And I've said this ad nauseum in different episodes. It is a huge frustration for me that people and clinicians do not diagnose personal line disorders prior to age 18. It is absolutely ridiculous. It is in the diagnostic manual. It says specifically that you can diagnose personality disorders in children and adolescents if they meet the diagnostic criteria, with the exception of antisocial, where you have to be 18. In the United States, that is a legal reason. But leaving somebody undiagnosed, you're setting them up for failure. And it's a huge frustration, because if you don't give some of the accurate diagnosis, or you sugarcoat it, that says more about, I think, the therapist than what it does about the science and the research and the information that we have available to us. So if you're not going to diagnose somebody if they meet the diagnostic criteria, you, I think, are doing a huge disservice to that individual. Last part of this question, or is it because care providers are constrained to an unreasonably short amount of time to make a formal diagnosis? Absolutely. Definitely, definitely, definitely. Whereas I get several hours with people, you know, the constraints in terms of managed care and even just, it'll take managed care or just, you know, life in general. Managed care gives therapists and prescribers an hour, 45 minutes to an hour, to come up with a preliminary diagnosis based upon, you know, someone's symptom presentation or someone's, you know, their clinical history. And, you know, I think you can get a decent ballpark. And again, no one's doing anything wrong. I just think to get to the, especially if you're going to, like I talked last week about ADHD, the only way to get ADHD is to actually have them get a neuropsych eval. I don't care what anybody says. You can use whatever rating scale you want. The only way to know is actually test the attentional systems. and to get the true depth of what constitutes the psychological architecture of an individual is to have the full neuropsych eval, because it gets to things. And even myself, as somebody who does, you know, sees a few people for therapy, there's no way I would ever know certain aspects about an individual without having access to the test data. And sometimes people are more comfortable responding to a question on paper, like the MMPI, or responding to different various rating scales, are more comfortable responding to that than being directly asked those questions. And that's why when I do the neuropsych eval and I go through the, you know, their individual's answers, you know, you can break the MMPI apart into different areas, the clinical scales, the validity scales, where you can tell someone's lying, faking, being overly defensive, the content scales, the supplementary scales, the restructured scales, and the Psi-5 scales. You're able to break it down. And this is the, you know, the science behind it, is you're able to figure out why, what explains the different elevations on the different scales. And that is a crucial part. And people, I think, are more likely, in my experience, are more likely to give you a true, you know, an honest answer to something that they're not having to maybe look at you in the face. But then the clinician could take that information and then ask the client, hey, I saw you endorse this specific question, and probe further. And that, you know, that has a lot of clinical utility and definitely benefit to it. All right. The second question, in your opinion, so I guess my opinion, is it possible for someone with borderline to actually coach themselves out of it, given enough time and willpower, without ever actually seeing in-person professional care? Or does the borderline condition inhibit the person from doing the necessary self-reflection without the intervention of external guidance? That is a great question. I think it borders on philosophy and existentialism. But if you ask for my professional opinion, no, I do not think borderline can be treated and cured without professional intervention. There are too many different techniques and interventions and just the way to treat it. Really, from my perspective, it requires a professional guidance and somebody who is very well trained in all the different various aspects of borderline personality. It's certainly, you know, to kind of add on to this question, it's certainly going to take the work of that individual and the greater level of insight and the greater level of discomfort and the greater level of motivation are huge in terms of a successful prognosis. And, you know, so is it going to take time? Yes. Is it going to take willpower? Yes. But without actually seeing a professional highly trained in this, no, I do not believe that you are going to be able to successfully treat this on your own. All right. Question number three. Can you explain the comorbidity between bipolar disorder and narcissism? All right. Again, two separate disorders. Narcissism is something that is learned. It is a product of environment. Early messages growing up in childhood, as I've said, personalities crystallize between 5 and 8 years of age. But personality can be changed with good therapy. Bipolar, again, is strictly neurotransmission. And do a lot of disorders look like each other? Absolutely. That is, borderline, bipolar, narcissism, histrionic, even antisocial, possibly dependent. There's a lot of symptom overlap. And again, the diagnostic process is able to parse out what it is and what it's not. And symptoms are not disorders. Some people, just because you've had a history of trauma, does not mean that you have PTSD. You have to meet diagnostic criteria. I think people sometimes they take one symptom and they run with it. And that's not accurate. The comorbidity between bipolar and narcissism, they're two separate disorders. Can they coexist at the same time? Absolutely. But two completely different etiologies. Next part of the say, is it generally because a bipolar quickly learns that the people around them will walk on eggshells to avoid conflict? See, bipolars who are also narcs, meaning narcissism, and some that weren't narcissistic at all. And the observation they've made over the years that narcissistic bipolars they've known had parents who didn't stick firm to boundaries. They treated the bipolar during the relationship of being diagnosed with the golden child, and they spent too much time appeasing the child to avoid conflict. That, again, is, you know, parental reactions to children's behaviors is, that's learning. That's learning theory. That's attachment theory. That has nothing to do with bipolarity. Bipolarity is genetic and it's chemical. Now, can environmental and parental reactions exacerbate symptoms? Absolutely. You know, could it make the depression in bipolar more severe? Sure. You know, could the mania, you know, be impacted? That's, again, that's much more of a chemical thing. But, you know, what are the reactions of people in the individual's life? If we just take family, for example, and somebody is highly manic and they're running down the street naked, and or they're up, you know, blasting the radio at 3 a.m. and frantically cleaning their room. I mean, it's going to impact people who are in proximity and close relationship with them, which may shape how the person with bipolar in that state perceives themselves and what insight they have. But it's, you know, it's really, you know, two people can experience the same thing and have two totally different reactions to it. And that's why I think, you know, there's a, you know, misconception between, you know, what is reality. I think reality is more about perception. Because two people can see the same thing, and like I said, have two totally different reactions to it. And if you're both seeing the same thing and have two totally different reactions, you know, the perception is really, I think, the reality that we live in. And I've used this example before. If you have a blue sky and you wear yellow tinted glasses, and I ask you what color is the sky, you're going to say green. Remember, you know, yellow and blue makes green. When in reality, the sky is still blue. It's just a matter of how you see things. All right, question 4 here. Regarding the unconscious mind, which I understand is a controversial topic, especially in your household. And Julie's here. I don't know if she'll pop on. I mean, but I'm not even sure what her perspective of the unconscious is, to be totally honest. To provide a framework, let's use the example. Do you want to talk about your... I think that's what she's doing. So my perspective of the unconscious is that it does not exist. Now, I'm not talking about the sympathetic nervous system and the autonomic nervous system, you know, that includes respiration and heart rate and blood flow. I mean, those things are outside of our control, you know, through meditation or mindfulness. We can, you know, impact them, you know, in a positive way. But the thought of that our behaviors and our cognitions are driven by this spooky underworld that Freud created, where you have the id, the ego, and superego. I think it was an interesting model, but in no way do I believe that the unconscious drives us. It's almost like saying that someone else made me do it. I have found Adler's definition to be a much more palatable one and a much more accurate one if we're going to use the term unconscious. And, you know, Freudians are going to disagree with me 100%, saying that we are driven by, I mean, it's not, no, we've mapped the brain out. Do we have a long way to go in terms of really understanding the potential of what the brain is capable of? But that gets into metacognition, which is basically thinking about thinking. And can the organism responsible for thought and cognition truly understand itself? That's a more of an existential question. But Adler's definition is the unconscious is simply that part of ourselves which we have yet to fully come to understand. That's so sometimes we make questions like, why do we do things? And that's really kind of what therapy is about. I think things are automatic and things are habitual, and we repeat things, whether they're right, wrong, indifferent, good, bad, acceptable, unacceptable, because they have valence, they have value. And if they have value, it's reinforced by the dopamine system. So all of these are interconnected. So she gives an example here. So to provide a framework, let's use the example of a girl who grew up in an abusive household. Dad was a mean drunk. He slapped mom around, maybe even slapped the kids around. Girl becomes a teenager, starts dating, mostly dates guys who are also abusive. Girl eventually marries a guy who slaps around, maybe even slaps the kid around. Maybe girl gets a divorce, perhaps even remarries a few years later, and of course she's married to another man who's abusive. Girl wonders how on earth she keeps getting herself into the situation. Would you say there might be some unconscious things at play here, her attraction to men who are like her father, or would you argue that the reason for her repeated behavior of going for abusive men is the result of the self-esteem problems that her father imposed on her as a child? In other words, she doesn't believe she's worthy of a good man who treats her with respect and dignity because she was never shown that kind of treatment growing up. Okay, good example. That whole story right there is what's called repetition compulsion. It's repeating the same behavior because we repeat things because, you know, it's like, why do people cut? Why do people engage in behaviors that society would say or the medical community would say is pathological, is unhealthy, is inappropriate, is wrong? Because it has value. And to the outside observer, it may seem, why are you doing this? Why do you keep dating the same person? So I think there's a familiarity. And, you know, does self-esteem probably factor into it? And I've worked with a lot of, you know, people in abusive relationships, and they'd rather, you know, rather them hit me than say the mean things about them. So yes, do early learning experiences shape us? Very much so. You know, we learn about love and about you know, conflict resolution, watching our parents or watching other people. And maybe you grew up in a household where, you know, dad did slap mom around. And then you go over to your friend's house and you realize that this father brings flowers home to his wife. And it seems like I'm living between two different worlds. And, you know, if, you know, sometimes, you know, I think there is a primal desire that all of us have to want to gain validation and approval from those who have raised us, whether they are our biological parents or adoptive parents or people who that had, you know, an impact on our life. And, you know, as unhealthy or as toxic as those individuals may be, I think it's a primal desire for acceptance and love and validation and waving, you know, the metaphorical flag, like look at me, dad, and look at me, mom, and, you know, did I make you proud? And sometimes people, it's sad, but sometimes those individuals, they don't necessarily withhold it, although I'm sure there are some that do, but sometimes there are a lot of individuals who simply don't have that to give. But, you know, we repeat things that are familiar. We repeat things that are, you know, like, you know, if we take borderline, a lot of individuals, you know, again, I'm just generalizing, but, you know, that I love you, don't leave me, or I love you, I hate you. You know, I'm not deserving of love. I'm not deserving of somebody kind. And because it feels so good, and at some point, it's going to stop. And I'm going to hurt you before you hurt me. And borderline is all about psychological survival. Again, totally different than bipolar. Borderline is, you know, is a personality style. It's a personality disorder. It's all about psychological survival. But I don't think there's anything unconscious at play. You know, but someone is choosing to, if they choose to get married to this abusive person, and they are choosing to leave, and if they choose to marry another person like that, that is a choice they are making. That is a conscious choice. It is not driven by some unconscious force. But the more familiar things are, it's easier to kind of understand how or why people make those decisions. If you just step back and suspend the judgment and just look at, why do you keep going to the gym every day? Why do you keep going to Starbucks every morning? Why do you keep doing whatever you're doing on a regular basis? Because it obviously has value. The psychological term, it has valence. That's the only reason we repeat behaviors, and it's reinforced again by dopamine, independent of whether it's appropriate or inappropriate or healthy or unhealthy. That's a really important point to understand, because if you can understand it from that perspective, then you can also understand how powerful our choices are. that as much as it, although it may be easier to gravitate towards what's familiar, the beauty of this is we also had, I did an episode of this maybe 2 years ago called Conscious Choices, that we have the ability to make different choices. And sometimes those different choices seem so foreign and they seem so scary because we don't know what the outcome is going to be, but we have a framework from previous experiences of what the outcomes have been in similar situations. But, you know, I've said before, but myself included, we live in yesterday and we live in tomorrow. We don't live in the present, and I will admit that to myself and to you guys. Absolutely, I'm thinking about all the stuff I have to do this week, and I think about all the things in the past. And you know, this whole thing about concept of mindfulness is awareness without judgment is the definition by Jon Kabat-Zinn, who developed the concept of mindfulness. Much easier for me to say and teach than it is to do. Perfectly honest. I mean, my mind is in 8 million different directions at any given time. Drives Julie crazy, but that's just how my mind works. My last question is extension of number 4. If everything new is a conscious decision, which it is, why do people find themselves attracted to a certain type? Can't count the number of people I've heard of. I have a certain type. I'm only attracted to these type of people. If everything we do is of the conscious mind, then is it possible to train ourselves to not be attracted to toxic people? My answer to that is absolutely. Absolutely. Then that is the whole point of, you know, the power of our cognitive set and what cognitive behavioral therapy is all about is what people do. That's interesting. That's fun for gossip. Why people do things, that's the part of treatment. That's the part of figuring out why do you do this. And getting to that piece, I work with enough faith to tell them, first of all, you can't change something until you first become aware of it. And sometimes you have to almost help people to verbalize something that they do not want to verbalize or don't even realize that they're in. Somebody say that you are in a toxic relationship. No, I'm not. No, you are in a toxic relationship. Really? Yeah, say it. You are in a toxic relationship. And then when you verbalize that, it takes on a whole different meaning in and of itself. And then there's a higher level of accountability of why, you know, you're probing why. And you know, you're not giving people, you know, not telling people break up with this person, leave this person. That's not how you really do therapy. But you know, you're guiding people to help them to come to their own conclusions and their own realization. And if somebody is actually engaged in therapy, you know, it's I think it's probably a fair assumption to say that. And they're talking about this. It's a fair assumption. Again, we shouldn't assume, but that they don't like this anymore. And as I've said in the episodes on change, is we only change when we're uncomfortable. And psychologically, and it's psychiatrically, when someone says, I'm tired of thinking, acting, feeling this way, that's the only way someone is going to change. But, you know, again, back to the comorbidities, you know, between bipolar and narcissism and borderline, these are I enjoy the personality disorders. They're fascinating because it's the consistency and in working with people, helping them, you know, when they start to see things differently, they start acting differently and they start feeling differently, and you know, therapy just kind of like takes off as people start to make shifts and changes, and you know, they're small at first, because I think if you focus so much on the end goal, you are going to be set up for failure. So I really appreciate this individual reaching out, because many of the episodes I've done are on borderline, and you know, we've talked a lot about bipolar, and I think these are great questions because these are things that I hear. And these are things that I deal with on a weekly basis. So it resonated very much with me, because these are questions I ask, and these are questions that I help patients that I work with work through. And And also, I hope you can understand, you know, how a lot of the different disorders have so much symptom overlap. And, you know, can you have several at the same time? Yes. And sometimes the clinical picture is very complex and requires, intervention on several different levels, possibly, you know, cognitive therapy, psychotropic medications, possibly EMDR for trauma, sometimes equine therapy. So, I think it helps to make things more linear. And, you know, the world is not linear. Our emotions are not linear. Our thoughts are not linear. But testing is it comes down to a black and white answer, and it gives answers. But what it's not able to do is figure out the why. But it gives a therapist or a clinician a ton of information to be able to work with and really understand and dissect, you know, what is the constitution of this individual. So hopefully I did justice to these questions, but I think they were great and very apropos, because this is stuff that I'm talking about and this is stuff that I'm confronting on a regular basis, and it's stuff I know that Julie and our colleagues are confronting on a regular basis. And but the whole notion of the unconscious is really a fallacy, because I think if people, you know, rely on that, it almost exempts them from responsibility that somebody else is controlling your mind. No. But I think, like I said, Adler's definition, there's a lot, you know, we function very much on autopilot. And you know, sometimes you got to step back and just notice. And sometimes step back and pay attention. And I'm not saying, you know, you have to get into this Zen state, but just, you know, pay attention. And the thing I've always said, right, if you ask the patients I work with, the one thing he says, pay attention to your motivation. That is the crucial part of beginning to make effective change. So until next time, feel free to reach out to me through psychologyunplugged@outlook.com. Get a hold of me through Psychology Today. You can reach me, you can follow us on Instagram at psychology_unplugged_ on Instagram. And you can contact me directly at 617-750-9411 East Coast Standard Time in the United States. Until next time, take care of yourselves, take care of each other. Feel free to email me like this individual did with topics that you'd like for me to discuss. I know borderline is one of the most popular ones, and I'm sure we'll revisit that multiple times as we continue on this collective journey. So I will talk to you guys next week. Thanks. Bye, guys.